Hello and welcome to The Week in Art. I'm Ben Luke. This week, the fate of artists in Gaza, Frank Stella remembered, and the Bloomsbury painter Vanessa Bell's view of her garden. I talked to the art newspaper's reporter, Savi Garanpaya, about her conversations with six Palestinian artists about their daily lives amid Israel's ongoing military offensive in Gaza. Frank Stella, one of the key artists in the history of American abstraction, has died aged 87. I speak to Bonnie Clearwater, the director and chief curator of the NSU Art Museum in Fort Lauderdale in Florida, who worked with Stella on two landmark shows. And as spring finally arrives in London, this episode's fitting work of the week is Vanessa Bell's View into a Garden from 1926. It features in an exhibition opening next week at the Garden Museum in London called Gardening Bohemia, Bloomsbury Women Outdoors. Emma Howes, the curator at the museum, tells me more. Would you like to share your views on the art newspaper and this podcast and help shape our future? If so, do complete our reader survey at theartnewspaper.com, where you can also subscribe. And do also subscribe to this podcast and our sister podcast, A Brush With, wherever you're listening. Please also give us a rating or review on Apple Podcasts. Now, over recent months, our reporter Savi Garanpaya has been talking to cultural workers in Gaza as they deal with the effects of Israel's military campaign in retaliation for Hamas's attacks in Israel on the 7th of October last year. On Thursday, the Gaza Health Ministry said that almost 35,000 Palestinians have been killed and more than 78,000 have been injured in the military offensive. The heritage and cultural infrastructure of Gaza has also been devastated. According to a report by the Palestinian Ministry of Culture in February, 32 cultural institutions in Gaza were damaged or destroyed during the first 4 months of the war. Savi spoke with six artists who have been active participants in Gaza's art scene: Basil El Makoswi, Suhel Salem, Rukhaya Alulu, Mohammed Abu Sal, Majdal Natil, and Khaled Hossein. They described their experiences during these turbulent times and their perspectives on the future for the arts in Gaza. I asked Savi about what they told her. Savi, I think it would be useful to begin by talking about the situation before the war, because even though Gaza was in a very extreme position at that time and there was a blockade and so on, there were still resources for artists and educators and so on. There was a meaningful place for people to go to make art and to learn about art and so on.
Yes. So in terms of formal education, there was Al-Aqsa University, which had a dedicated art college. And that's where people went to get their formal education. It came a little bit later on. So it was mid-90s onwards that it came about. But the fantastic thing was that artists and people interested in arts decided to take it upon themselves to set up spaces to develop arts in Gaza. And this led to the opening of spaces like Eltaka and Shababik, which were basically the backbone of the art community in Gaza. And when I speak to people in Gaza, the artists, they speak so passionately about the art scene and about how vibrant it was. And these spaces weren't just about artists. These spaces developed really elaborate programs that targeted not just artists, but people in the community, children, because they recognized how influential arts was to the mental state of people and children, especially living under the circumstances that people in Gaza were living under occupation, under on and off bombardments. So there were quite targeted programs. And on the other hand, they describe a really vibrant, really active scene where if they held exhibitions, it wasn't just artists or people interested in arts that were attending these spaces. They talk about, you know, hundreds of people coming to the exhibitions, people just from the community to see what is going on, what are these pieces, what is being presented. And people in the community really responded to what these artists were doing in places like Shababik and Eltaka, which unfortunately have now been destroyed.
I mean, there's even a section where one of the people you talk to talks about it almost in idyllic terms. You know, the circumstances were horrific even then, but they're talking about it as an idyllic space, a space of imagination and a space of making art and therefore dreaming a bit, effectively.
Absolutely. So they talk about the difficulties of setting the spaces up. So El Takal started, I think, in 2002, if memory serves me right. Shababi came a little bit later on, 2009, officially. So Shababi came after Hamas took over the Gaza Strip. And it was almost directly as a response to that, because there was so much restrictions. They were at a time they describe not having any sort of art material being allowed into the Gaza Strip. So artists were having to really improvise about what they did. And this is actually part of their other programs, because they know the restrictions that they're under and the restrictions that can come about at pretty much any moment. So they really work on teaching students about how to come up with new ways of expressing themselves through whatever means they have available around them. And as time went on, so from 2007, there was really strict blockade, and what was entering Gaza was heavily controlled by Israel, and art material, from what they describe, were pretty much non-existent. What they could find, they say, was smuggled in. But with time, these art material, they started to be able to find them more, and then they were able to travel. So if they traveled, they would buy their own material, because they also describe not being able to get good quality material in Gaza, because the people who are importing these are not art experts. They are just, you know, okay, let's get a bit of paint and take it in. So yeah, it was a very promising scene is what they describe.
Right. And as you say, they've now been destroyed. This infrastructure for artists and educators is no longer there anymore. So tell me about how you got in touch with the people involved, because lots of the people that you talk to are the people behind El Tika and Shababik. So how did you reach out to them, and how available are people to talk to? Because I think one of the things that people are not aware of is just how much are these people online, how much are they able to get access to the internet and so on. And so how hard did you have to work in a way to get hold of these people?
It was actually quite hard. It took a long time to put the story together. It actually started as a different story.
Right.
It started out as a smaller story where I was looking into El Takal. And I was looking for one of the co-founders. There's seven of them. And I was looking for one particular artist. And getting hold of him was so difficult. And the response time, because of lack of electricity, because of lack of internet. So starting with this person, it was incredibly slow. So I would get a response every 5-6 days, maybe sometimes, you know, over a week. It was going incredibly slow. So in that time that I was researching what else is going on in the art scene, I came across Shababik, and unfortunately it had been destroyed. This was at the time that there was a raid, Israeli forces raided the Al-Shifa hospital, and when they departed, there was just nothing left of Shababik. It's rubble. You can see it's just flattened. Now, Shababik was hit previously. It was bombed, but the structure was standing. There's pictures of the inside of the building. It was there. Maybe we can call it minor damage. But now the images were just, there was nothing left. So that led to, okay, what's going on with this art space? And trying to find who were the artists involved with Shababik. And I became somewhat of a stalker. So trying to find the artists, social media, if I have any contacts, do you know this person? Do you know that person? Mm. Email, Instagram, Facebook, Telegram, you name it. I would bombard people with, this is who I am. I would like to speak to you. And it's very difficult in a sense that you also have to be very understanding of their position. They're literally trying to stay alive. And, you know, here I am. Can I speak to you about, you know, a building that was destroyed? I understand this was perhaps definitely an important part of their lives, but still, there's nothing more important than human life. And people are trying to stay alive and protect their families. So trying to build that trust of, you know, please speak to me, I would like to know your story, and, you know, convince them to speak to me. And eventually I got through and managed to speak to several people.
And talking to them, one of the things that's really remarkable from your story is that you cover a kind of a scale of displacement that, however much we hear about the events happening overnight on the news or whatever, just these individual stories of displacement, multiple displacements from one person or one family, the way that families are separated from one another in multiple locations, it's really stark just how much these people's lives have been utterly shattered by the experience. Was it hard then to talk to them about art making, or did they volunteer the information in a way? Because that's what they do. That's a fundamental part of their being. And I'm interested in, you know, of course you're talking about the terrible things that are happening on a daily basis, but to what extent is their art making part of them and therefore part of what they wanted to talk to you about?
I didn't feel at any point that anyone felt uncomfortable talking about the art. And I always started by asking them about them and how they were doing and what had happened to them. So I always made a point of starting with that, because that was the most important part of the story, what's happened to these people. And everyone has a separate story. Everyone has a different story. Everyone has a new angle to share. You know, we have six people and every one of them is a unique case. So we talked about their stories first, and then I asked them about the arts. But like, you're 100% right, arts is a part of them. It's not something separate. The lady in this story, Ruqayya, she repeatedly said, every time she talked about her paintings, and I really felt her pain, I have lost everything. She would repeat the word lost again and again and again. They've lost more than the locations of work. They've lost more than just being displaced. They have no home to go back to. In some cases, it's just rubble.
That's right. Several of them have been displaced, gone back home and found there's nothing there.
Absolutely. So I don't know what I would do in that situation. Mentally, I am in a completely different location to where my home is, and I have no home to go back to. I have perhaps no family who has a home that I can go and stay with, because everybody else is in the same boat as me. So you felt the loss. But at the same time, speaking to people like Basil, who is one of the co-founders of Eltaka, he's relentless. He talks about his home. And this is the second time, actually, that his home has been destroyed. His home was destroyed in a previous war. He rebuilt it, and now it's gone again. His home is close to the Israeli border. So it was one of the first areas that was attacked. And he's lost everything in the sense that he talks about having archives of his family history, photographs. His family was displaced in 1948 and they became refugees. They moved to the Gaza Strip. So in his archives, he had a lot of pictures and family memories of his past, and it's all gone. How he's as positive as he is, how he's still going. He is teaching children right now. He's teaching art. He is drawing himself. He uses whatever means he has to still create art. And he shares that on his Instagram and on his Facebook. And you see him smiling. And when he speaks so beautifully about the need to go on and the need to fight and continue creating art.
And there's this remarkable detail of his story, which is that he's teaching the children in the refugee camps, and then the mothers ask him if they can be taught and if they can make art too, because they'd seen how it affected their own children and they also have stories to tell.
Yes, he was displaced from the north, and like everyone else who has been displaced, everyone I have certainly spoken to, it's not a case of they have moved from their hometown to where they are now, whether it's Rafah in the south or in central Gaza. They have been displaced several times because they moved from place to place. And then, you know, every time they moved somewhere, they were told they had to move again. So when he finally reached Rafah, he walked around and he was just really heartbroken. Basil has worked with children, as he says, for over 20 years. And he was just heartbroken to see children carry out these really hard chores. And we see these images, perhaps we don't really pick up on what's going on, but because of the hardships of life right now in Gaza, there is no water, there is no food, there is no simple way of washing, there's no simple way of cooking. You have to make fire from scratch. So that means you have to go collect wood, cartons. If you want to cook your rice, if you can afford or find rice from the aid agencies, you need to make that with water. There is real lack of water in some areas. So who's doing this? If you have to do repeated trips to where you have to get water, children are doing this. Many children, because they have to help the family out. We're talking about big families, so how much water is needed per day. So when he saw this, he was so moved, he was so heartbroken, as he put it, that, of course, on top of all of this, on top of all this hardship, the children had witnessed just things that children should never witness. No one should witness, but in particular children, they'd seen death, they'd seen dead bodies, they've seen destruction. So mentally, they were really in a dark place. And he decided to start working with them with arts, with paintings, and getting them to express themselves. And it really made such an impact that, like you said, the mothers said, oh, do this for us. And he says when he did that, he did do that with the mothers. And it was just a session of tears as the mothers let out whatever feelings they were holding in. It was just tears coming out through these workshops. And he's posted some of the work that he does on his social media, Facebook, Instagram. He's quite active on Instagram. Some charities got involved and they have provided money so that he can buy paint and continue what he's doing. Because initially he did it himself. It was just him taking an interest to, I can't let this happen. And this goes back to how even El Takar started. They see something that needs people like Basil, that needs fixing, that needs addressed, and they take action. And here he is living in a tent for the last several months, and he's doing what he can to make sure that at least children are mentally in a slightly better place.
That's extraordinary. One of the things about his story, and about indeed all the stories that you're telling, is about that compulsion to make art. It's really interesting that even despite the fact that, as you say, they are literally having to try and find firewood and so on, all the people that you're talking to are trying to make art. By hook or by crook, they will try and make art. And it's extraordinary, that, isn't it? That, because, of course, they have so much else to be thinking about, but the compulsion's there. It's their profession. It's what they've always done. And so they are doing it still. And it's that to me, that sort of level of resilience seems extraordinary.
Absolutely. I think it's so embedded in them. It's part of them. They can't get away from it. And with the hardships, with what they're experiencing right now, there is no privacy. So people for the last, let's say, at least 6 months, we're entering the 8 months of the war, but let's say people were displaced a little bit later on. So 6-7 months living in a tent. We've all seen the images of these tents, tent after tent after tent. So there is no privacy. You can hear what's going on in the next tent. So families have no privacy. As an individual, if you think about how we all need just that maybe 5-10 minutes of day to ourselves, they don't have that luxury. If they're not running around trying to find food and water and then come back and make the fire to try and make some sort of food, they have no choice but to be completely integrated with everyone around them. So I think art is an escape for them, because it's the only time, whether it's even 5-10 minutes of day, they get to escape the horrors and just be through drawing or painting. And that gives them peace for a short while. That it provides an escape. That's how they describe it. And it's remarkable, really.
Yeah, indeed it is. You wrote a related piece, which was about cultural workers in February. One of the things that struck me about that is, and it's true of the artists too, is that whole disciplines are under threat. So you spoke to, for instance, archaeologists and so on. You talked about the artist whose archive has gone, but also his equipment has gone. It seems to me that it's a struggle even for most of the people you spoke to practice their basic discipline, even when the war ends. Like you say, that the art centres are gone. Is there going to be a scope for archaeology after the war with so much rubble around and so on? It seems to me that that's a crucial factor, is that it's that entire landscape of culture and heritage that is being wiped out with the buildings themselves.
It's very tragic, yes. This is a land that has so much history, and it's our collective history. This is not just Gaza's history. There's thousands of years of heritage of history in Gaza. And most of them, if I was to think about the best known sites, they're gone or heavily damaged. I think there's only one site, St. Hilarion, that is reported to have minor damage. UNESCO has given it enhanced protection, meaning UNESCO was very swift to act on that particular site and issue it with enhanced protection, which means if anyone damages this site, they will be prosecuted. There will be legal action. But other than that site, I can't think of a site that hasn't been damaged. And it really is a question. The cultural workers, archaeologists in particular, were saying that we don't know what we're going to do after the war. They were quite keen to go and investigate what had happened. So the passion was very much there. It was, we want to go. And it was all, we want the war to end so that we can go and start our work of assessing and developing reports of what work needs to be done, what restoration needs to be done. But then you speak to them other days and you see that there's nothing left. There are areas where some of these sites are that's just flat. There's nothing left. So there is no hope, and I can understand that. And the other issue that they're all very aware of is that when the rebuilding work starts, there are so many priorities. People have no home. The infrastructure, all other infrastructure, energy, everything is gone. There's no water. There's raw sewage everywhere right now because the sewage works are not working. There is no fuel, so they're not running. There's no water supply. So there is so much to be done. I think a UN report estimated that it would take, if I'm not mistaken, something like 15 years, 14 years to clear out the rubble out of Gaza. So I think when you put those priorities, would archaeology be in that list? And I've asked the question again and again from the Palestinian ministry, and they say, look, there will be something. We hope there is something. We hope that donors, it was always foreign donors that contributed to archaeology and had the archaeology projects in Gaza anyways. So they hope that those donors will continue. As a minimum, they say there will be emergency work to go in and first of all, create the reports, do the investigation, what work needs to be done, and then carry out any emergency work. But what that does mean is that people who work in this field have little hope, which means they will not stay in Gaza. The mood has changed for some when I'm still in touch with the cultural workers that you mentioned, and they're looking to leave because they see the level of damage. They have no home to go back to. They have no work to go back to for the foreseeable future. The children have no schools to go to. If they're students, university students, all 11 universities in Gaza have been destroyed. So the archaeology students, the art students, they have nowhere to go. How long will it take to rebuild the university? One professor was quite positive where he said, well, during Corona, we did everything online, so hopefully we can do that. So the hope was there, but how realistic is that? So that unfortunately leads to many people in this field choosing to try and find a way out of Gaza.
Right. I think you wanted to end this discussion by telling our listeners about a correspondence that you'd had with one of the people you spoke to in the article, Sohail Salem. You contacted him to say that you would be coming onto the podcast today, and you asked him if he had anything he wanted to tell us. And what was his reply?
Yes. So a little bit about Sohail. Sohail was one of the co-founders of Iltaka. He was also involved in Shababik. He was one of the first students to go to Al-Aqsa University when the art course opened. And he's an international artist. He was from the north. He chose to stay in the north of Gaza when the evacuation orders came because he didn't want to leave his home. He was really set on not leaving his home. So he moved areas. He's still staying in the north, but he moved to his family home. Then he moved to a friend's home. And he describes scenes where there's bombardments. He's very lucky to be alive from what he's described because next door neighbor's house has been hit. Several neighbors, he's lost relatives, neighbors. And finally, I think he lasted about 3 months, and there was a period, a very short period, where there was no bombardments in his area. And suddenly the Israeli forces appeared in his neighborhood. And he, I think he describes ordering people to come out and everyone was lined up. Everyone was restrained, including his children, 11-year-old, 15-year-old. I think he said he has a 2-year-old, and his 2-year-old was the only one who was not handcuffed. So he was taken away. Quite an ordeal. He was interrogated. It took him 2 days to find his family. He was ordered, you can't stay here. You've got to go to somewhere else. So he had to move to central Gaza. He was still didn't want to go to Rafah, which is where many people chose to go, because he wanted to be close to his home. It was very important for him to be close to his home. He really didn't want to be in a tent. He didn't want to be displaced. And when he found his family, I think it took a month or so, he finally started to sketch. He'd seen so much during this time. He described seeing dead bodies. And I think what upset him the most was the knowledge that his children had seen these images. Hmm. And he always said that I see it. I'm not important, but my children seeing dead bodies in the street, it was something that really hurt him. But he started sketching, and he started putting these sketches on his social media, on Facebook, and started to really get attention. And it got somewhat of a following. So I asked him, what do you want to tell people? If the war was to end tomorrow, what do you hope for? What do you want? And I know, having spoken to him several times, that Suhail always talks about going home. He's stayed close as he can to his hometown. And he always talks about a ceasefire. So every conversation ends with or has elements of, I want a ceasefire because I want to go home. It's just all about him going home. So I said to him, if you could share with people your thoughts about what would you do tomorrow? If there was a ceasefire tomorrow and you could have anything you wanted, what do you want? And this is what he had to say. And I'll try and do this justice. It brought tears to my eyes, Ben, when I first received it. So I'll try and get through this. What do I hope for? I have so many wishes. I hope this was a nightmare and I wake up and everything is fine. I want the war to end. I want to have a free homeland that is not under siege, that has no borders. I want to travel without waiting months for my turn to travel. I want my home. I want my relatives and friends who were killed back. I want us to be well and at peace. I was born while the occupation existed. I don't want occupation. I don't want wars. I want to have a studio in which I can draw, read and write, and have flowers, plants, and small cactus around. And I drink my coffee with my friends. I want you to one day to be able to visit me in Gaza. Gaza is beautiful. Beautiful with good people. I want to laugh. I want to finally own a car, even though I have had a driving license for 30 years. I want to attend my art exhibitions. I want so much. Your question hurt me a lot because it made me think about all the things that I want.
Savi, thank you very much.
Thank you, Ben.
You can read Savi's articles on Gaza on the website or the app. Coming up, we remember Frank Stella and enjoy a view into Vanessa Bell's garden. But first, here's this week's news bulletin. Researchers working in Giza in Egypt have identified an anomaly beneath the sand, which may be a previously unknown L-shaped structure. The discovery was made using ground-penetrating technology in a cemetery beside the Great Pyramid of Khufu. The joint Japanese-Egyptian research team that made the discovery said that the structure could be artificial because the L-shape cannot be created in natural geological forms. It was identified in an apparently empty blank area of Giza's Western Cemetery, where members of the royal family and high-level officials were buried in tombs called mastabas, rectangular funerary chapels where ancient Egyptians made offerings to the dead, with shafts leading to underground burial chambers. Previously, there had been no significant discoveries in this area, around 80 by 110 metres in size, despite it being surrounded by ancient mastaba tombs and located beside the pyramids of Kings Khufu and Khafre, built 4,500 years ago. The research team said that the survey points to the possibility of the presence of archaeological remains and should be promptly excavated to establish their purpose. Officials at the Palais de Tokyo Contemporary Art Center in Paris say they strongly reject accusations of ideological programming made by the patron Sandra Hegedus. Brazilian-born Hegedus has quit the Friends of the Palais de Tokyo patrons group, withdrawing her financial support after 15 years. She accused the center of what she called wokeism, saying that a recent exhibition on Palestine offered biased and misleading points of view on the history of this conflict. On X, formerly Twitter, Hegedus, who founded the non-profit SAM Art Projects, says in her bio details that she's a proud Zionist. In a lengthy statement, the Palais de Tokyo's president, Guillaume Desange, said that Philippe Dian, the president of the Friends, has expressed his ongoing support for the Palais de Tokyo, recalling that the Friends' mission is to support the Palais, not to pass judgment on its programming. Gustave Courbet's painting, The Origin of the World, from 1866, an explicit full-frontal female nude, has been vandalised by protesters who daubed the work with the words, Me Too. The glazed picture is on loan from the Musée d'Orsay in Paris to the Centre Pompidou Metz in northern France. It appears in a show called Lacan the Exhibition, When Art Meets Psychoanalysis, which explores the theories of the French psychoanalyst Jacques Lacan, who owned Courbet's infamous painting. A spokesperson for the Centre Pompidou Metz confirmed that Courbet's work had been defaced, adding that five works in total in the show were covered with the words Me Too. The Luxembourg-born artist Deborah de Robertis posted a video showing the protest on the platform Vimeo. In an accompanying statement, she said she wanted to highlight the misogynistic divide in the art world. You can read all these stories and much more on the website or the app. Now, Frank Stella, a towering figure in the field of abstract art, has died aged 87. His death on the 4th of May at his home in New York City was announced by Marianne Boesky Gallery, which has represented Stella since 2014. Stella was 23 and had been painting in New York City for a year when he made his debut on the city's art scene in 1959 with his austere, striped, monochrome black paintings series. Shown in the historic 16 Americans exhibition at the Museum of Modern Art in 1959, the black paintings gained instant attention and were the start of a seven-decade engagement with abstraction that made him one of the most celebrated artists of his time. Across those 65 years, Stella continued to work in groups of paintings, from the similarly geometric but multicoloured series of the 1960s and 1970s, like the concentric squares and mitered mazes, to the shaped canvases in the irregular polygon and Polish village series, to the infinite variety he conjured in the protractor works, the more freeform shapes and colours of the Brazilian and exotic birds, the architectonic and sculptural works he called pillars and cones, the loose and lyrical Hulumulu paintings, and the energetic relief of the Scarlatti Kirkpatrick series. Stella exhibited relentlessly through his life, with major retrospectives in New York at the Museum of Modern Art in 1970 and 1987, and at the Whitney Museum of American Art in 2015. Two other important shows of his work were Frank Stella at 2000, Changing the Rules, at the Museum of Contemporary Art Miami, and Frank Stella Experiment and Change, a vast 300-work exhibition at the NSU Art Museum Fort Lauderdale in Florida. The curator of these latter two exhibitions was Bonnie Clearwater, the NSU Art Museum's director, whose current show is an overview of colour field painting that features works by Stella. I spoke to Bonnie about Stella's life and work and her experiences of working with him. Bonnie, I wanted to talk about the very bold decision that I think you came to with Frank Stella when you worked on the retrospective of his work at Fort Lauderdale, which was to not include the very seminal black paintings, those paintings which made him so famous at such a young age, because they were so kind of totemic in his whole history. But I guess what you wanted to say is there's so much more to Frank Stella than the black paintings, right?
Absolutely. Well, actually, that was the second major retrospective I worked with Stella on. The first one was in 1999, and that was a retrospective or a survey of his works from the 1990s. It was called Frank Stella at 2000, Changing the Rules. And you know, his works from the 1990s seem so dramatically different from the works that made his reputation, the black stripe paintings of the late 1950s, early 60s. And for most people, looking at these, what might be called maximalist paintings and maximalist outright sculptures. He actually, in the 90s, created sculptures, and he also made a foray into architecture and this concept of a fully inhabitable space. What I realized that if one started from the position that he was a minimalist, from the beginning. It was almost impossible to reconcile the works from the 90s onwards. But if you realize he was never a reductionist, and that the black stripe paintings themselves had been misrepresented or misinterpreted, and understood that right from the beginning, he was thinking in concepts of space, of a pictorial space that was real as opposed to illusory, the kind of Renaissance perspective. Mm. That's what was thrilling. How do you make this space for the viewer that actually seems real? So once I threw out this idea that he was a minimalist, it all fell into place. And in fact, the black stripe paintings were a kind of cleansing for him, because before that he was working with stripes and with a kind of drippy, messy brushstroke. And we actually did have the very first black stripe painting in the exhibition in 2017, the exhibition Frank Stella, Experiment and Change. The painting is called Delta, and it started out like his other stripe paintings of the late 1950s. I mean, he was right out of Princeton.
You know? Yeah, amazing. And 23, 22 years old.
Yeah, you know, and they were stripes of alternating red and blue colors in most cases. And he looked at it at the studio and realized it wasn't working. You know, there was too much fluctuation going on in the form. He actually uses this very technical term of how he appraises his own works. It was fussy. Had nothing to do with about minimalism or purity. He just wanted to get away from fussiness. And he wasn't alone, which is one of the points of the Color Field show that's on now.
Right.
So he looked at it and he decided the way to get out of this fussiness and this vacillation between the two colors going back and forth was to paint them out in black. And in the morning, he looked at it and realized what he had done. So now he knew what he was going to paint. He was going to paint these black stripes. And Stella had the position, there's two problems that an artist faces, what to paint and how to paint it. So now he's determined what he's going to paint. It worked. It did what he was doing.
What did he do?
However, he still didn't know how to paint it. It was still drippy and fussy and messy. That the reason of getting away from that drippiness and painterliness was because by that time, the abstract expressionistic brushstroke had become manneristic. It had lost its expression. It was just a thing. And he and other artists of his generation moved away from it for that reason. It no longer had meaning to it. No longer had that emotional meaning to them. So he ultimately moves from this kind of brushy and drippy brush strokes to doing something that actually is personal to him. And this is an important point, and something that I realized with this show was that what was personal to him was growing up in Malden, Massachusetts. His father, who was a famous doctor, who loved as his hobby to paint houses. And he and Frank, you know, starting from childhood, would paint together. And so Frank was, to him, painting with a house brush had meaning to him. And while he's painting, he could be probably thinking of his father, which did have an emotional impact to him, which is completely a different way of thinking about Stella and his switch from the messy brush strokes to what looks to most people very austere and very minimal, but it had meaning to him. And it was something he could do quite well. I mean, he knew how to do a mitered maze perfectly by hand.
Well, that's it. Yeah, and exactly. And that's one of the interesting things, isn't it? Because, of course, people talk about the hard edges and so on, but they're so handmade, those paintings. You're absolutely right, as he follows the progression, because he does the black paintings for a very short period.
Very short.
And then he's moving into high colour, you know, and so you have a whole sequence of, again, very hand-painted, very self-made paintings, which are actually gloriously handmade, actually, I think.
And deliberately handmade. Mm. I mean, one of the interesting things with our current color field show, Glory of the World, where we have different phases of early works by Stella, people are amazed to see the work up close, that even though he did rule lines, they were hand-painted. He just used that as a guide, and there is a bleed, and there's a softness to the edge that did come from Rothko, and it came from Matisse, that he realized that that softness is what kept the painting alive. It breathed life into it. And sometimes, such as in the irregular polygons, he was very deliberate about creating this kind of vibration, because from a distance, it might look like it's a hard edge, but there's a vibration in your eye that keeps the whole surface moving. So yes, it was a deliberate idea to move away from the black stripe, but we had the black stripe that makes it clearer what he was trying to do. The other thing that was unique about that retrospective was that for the first time ever, he wanted to show his working archives. And there was one work that looked like one of the black stripe paintings in the show, in the archives. And it was a variation of short and long black stripes, horizontal stripes, on a small piece of sandpaper. And it was 1960, so it postdated the black stripe paintings. And so I said, so Frank, what is this? And he has this way of, he would just gesture something, said, oh, it was based on the I Ching. I usually didn't have a follow-up question with him because it was more fun to figure it out. And I had worked with Merce Cunningham and John Cage, so I Ching, okay, everyone's using I Ching at that time as chance, and it was a way of getting away from making conscious decisions. But I knew that's not what Frank was doing. So I read up on the I Ching and discovered that it's made up of, there's 64 possible permutations of these short and long lines. And so I said, Frank, did you make another one of these? And he said, no. I said, you didn't have to because you knew what you were going to do after this. The black stripe paintings were not planned as a series. They became a series after the fact. After 1960, most of the early works were series. But not only were they series, this idea of being permutations in advance. As I said, his major concern was what to paint and how to paint it. Once you decide what to paint, you could just concentrate on how to paint it. So from then on, he pretty much calculated in advance what the potential permutations of each series were in the shapes he had chosen and the colors he chose. Not that he didn't change while he was working on it,
right.
But that was the theory. And one other point about the I Ching, one of the permutations is the star.
Ah.
Okay, so the star becomes one of the signature, literally signature images that repeats from the 60s to, I hate to say, towards the end of his life.
Yeah.
And everyone always wants to assume, well, Stella in Italian, of course he was Italian, mm-hmm. is star. So that was the other in thing about the I Ching.
How amazing.
It produces the star that he always used. Yeah.
One of the great things that you talk about him working in series, and one of the things I was doing in preparation for talking to you was writing down all the different series in sequence. And one of the things that's amazing about doing that is you just realize how productive he was and how much he was experimenting. I mean, your show was called Experiment and Change. I mean, he is consistently testing himself, isn't he? And I love that, you know, there's interviews in the art newspaper in our archive where he's very matter of fact. He says, some things work, some things don't. I'm just trying things out. I'm pushing my practice. Yeah. I'm pushing myself, you know. And that was a consistent mantra of his, wasn't it?
Yes. In fact, when I worked on the first show in 2018-19, people didn't realize how funny he was. I mean, even in the written interviews, I look at it and I start cracking up because I know the interviewer doesn't have a clue that he's being funny. So he gives me a tour of his studio. This was on East 13th Street in Greenwich Village at the time. It was like walking around doing a tour of a factory with, you know, the owner or somebody. And he gestures over to this long table and he says, and there's research and development. And on the table are orange peels in various degrees of decay and twisting and turning. And he had recently come back from China, where most people, when you go to the cities, you're amazed of how bamboo is used everywhere, especially for scaffolding or for deliveries, that delivery people would have bamboo on their shoulders and carrying objects that way. And he was in the process of experimenting on how to bend and shape bamboo, which he did for a number of works in the early 2000s that were wonderful, which he ultimately discovered was too hard to work in the bamboo, and it consequently turned to metal that he could bend and twist. So there was an example of something that he was trying out, and he knew what he wanted to do, but the material just was too hard.
And with so many artists, there's a sense in which they're defined by some sort of early work, and they are then concerned to tarnish their own reputation. It didn't seem like he had any concern about tarnishing reputations and so on. He just was interested in pushing things. So literally, as you say, making maximalist work, making the furthest thing from reductive and spare work you can possibly make, in a way.
Well, as my point is, if you really look at especially the mitered mazes and concentric squares, there's nothing minimal about them. Count how many stripes he gets into one 6-foot square or 7-foot square canvas. Mm. If you look at it that way, he's always been a maximalist. But that wasn't really the point. When we did the second show together, which, by the way, was by his request, he approached me, I guess it was 2014 or 15, not long after I took over as director at NSU Art Museum Fort Lauderdale, which was in 2013, that he wanted to work with me on a concept of doing a retrospective that did not run chronological. He was working with the Whitney at the time on the big retrospective there, and that was almost strictly chronological and by series. But that's not the way he works. So he proposed doing an exhibition that would really reveal how he thinks. And it's not sequentially, it's more circuitous. And that the ideas that are in the later works were there in the beginning. So it wasn't even, to him, a difference. There was a continuity there, which is what we unveiled in that exhibition. You know, talking about how he appraised his own works when we did the first show together in 99-2000, they were tough works. I mean, and there too, he primarily, especially in the sculptural, the 3D work, went back to basically this idea of removing color and doing more of a monochrome in these, you know, either it was the metal that he was using or whatever. They were more dark brown than black. So again, it was this emptying of the color to get back to that beginning again. But also it was the first time he had returned in the 90s to painting on flat canvas. And these were unbelievable, still completely underrated paintings. And he would come pretty much every week from New York. And that show was at Museum of Contemporary Art in North Miami. We actually set up armchairs for him in the lobby where he would sit and read the newspaper.
How great.
And then we'd have lunch, and then we'd come back and he'd walk through the show looking at it. And many times he would be talking out loud basically to himself, questioning why people didn't see it. And in fact, during one of those occasions, there were some visitors from Ohio, and they pulled me aside because they were overhearing this. And they said, "We can't believe we're here listening to Frank Stella questioning himself." You know, you look at the work and it's all so assured and it looks like it's so deliberate and masterful, which it is. Now, he wasn't even questioning himself. He was questioning why the audience hadn't come along yet to realize what he was doing. And I told him, it's going to take time. It happened to me when I was first approached to do the survey of the 90s. I went up to the studio and looked at these, you know, really monstrous works. I'm like, I don't know if I could do this. And I went back the next day, and all I can explain is that there was some kind of shift that happened in my own brain, that the logic of these works fell into place. And I thought that these were the most beautiful works and brilliant works I'd ever seen.
One of the things that's so fascinating is his relationship with art history, of course. And I know that when you did the show at the NSU Art Museum, you concentrated very much on this very early experience he had with Rogier van der Weyden. But there's this really curious balance, isn't there? Because he's utterly reverent towards the great abstract painters of the early 20th century, people like Malevich and Kandinsky and Mondrian and so on. But he also has a deep reverence for somebody like Caravaggio and Rogier van der Weyden, as I say. And also, you know, he writes brilliantly, or rather talks brilliantly about them in his book Working Space, which was made from lectures he gave. He's a great scholar of art history, actually, isn't he?
He's a wonderful writer and one of the best copy editors I've ever had.
Interesting.
He's brilliant. Yeah, well, it's not so much a reverence for art history. There is a consistency there as well. So very early on in our relationship, I realized that Frank was uncomfortable having a face-to-face conversation. But get into a car and would drive to his foundry in upstate or his studio in Brooklyn, and he's facing straight ahead and he can talk stream of consciousness. And early in our, on the way to the Brooklyn studio when we were doing the Experiment and Change show, he just starts talking. And it's like he's just remembering it for the first time because he doesn't talk about the van der Weyden in Working Space. Mm. It's like it already all of a sudden popped in his mind. And he had this experience when he was still a student at Princeton. He went to Philadelphia Art Museum, didn't expect to see this painting, turned a corner, and it just hit him all at once.
It's the crucifixion diptych he's talking about.
At that time it was called the crucifixion diptych. Since then, the scholarship is that it was probably a triptych.
Right.
But it was important that he did realize it, see it as a diptych. And so it wasn't so much about the art history or even the subject matter. It was, wow, a painting can do this. Now, here he is, the generation that follows the abstract expressionists, are totally committed to abstract painting. You know, it's so hard for us today to believe how strong this idea of progress in art was in mid-century. But by that point, it would have been considered going backwards to put the figure in. So there was really no choice. If you wanted to be avant-garde and you wanted to be modern, it meant painting abstract, at least in New York. Mm-hmm. But there were things about that painting that so well translated to what he was doing. Part of it being this concept, again, getting away from the fussiness, was to get rid of this relational compositions. You have a square or a rectangle, you balance this against that. Again, he considered that fussy.
Right.
How do you get away from the fussiness? And even Donald Judd talks about this too. And Nolan, how do you get away from fussiness, use symmetry? Mm. Which, well, that's why I'm saying the fact that he saw that painting as a diptych was important, right? Because you have two sides. At the same time, even when his paintings are symmetrical or, you know, look like they have two sides, like the double concentric squares or the double mitered mazes series, they're not identical because the pattern, the permutation on each side is different. I finally figured out the one that we have at our museum. He said, there's a repeat there, but I can't remember where it is. I finally figured it out last week, and I was going to tell him I did it. But at least I know I figured it out. But it's symmetry, but it's not symmetry. It also, if you look at that crucifixion, it's very minimal. There's just the crucifix in the center on one panel, and there's these red minimal forms in the back. Mm. And it just pushes the whole scene forward, and you just have this pow. Now, the reason I'm saying it wasn't just an admiration for that artist or that particular work, it was the experience he had. And the same thing in the first exhibition, we published his writings from the 90s. And one of the essays was on Hans Hofmann. It was called Hans Hofmann at 2000 Bombs Away, which became the origins of my exhibition, Glory of the World, color field painting. So he writes about Hofmann in the same way. So remember, I had published this before I learned about the crucifixion diptych. And I went back and read that essay, and it's all there. And describing Hofmann, what was it about Hofmann that got him? It was, well, it talks about the painting Gloria Mundi by Hofmann, Glory of the World. and how in Hoffman's paintings, again, it hits you right away. It gives you this jolt. It gives you an emotional jolt. And that's an important thing to understand about Stella, is that I once said to him, I don't care what you say, I find your work very emotional. And he said, I never said my work wasn't emotional. They said it. And in fact, if you go back to the 1972 movie documentary, Painter's Painting, with Stella sitting on the floor talking stream of consciousness, it's great. He talks about why would anyone say his work is unemotional? Would you say Beckett's work, which is, you know, really slimmed down, or Rothko, for that matter, who he said is even more minimal than me, would you say their work is unemotional? Why would you say mine is? And I realize one of the reasons, well, it happened for most of that generation of artists I've worked with, like Lichtenstein and Malcolm Morley and Archwager, they all said early on their work was to get away from the emotion of the abstract expressionist. But with Stella, it was the first, I guess, statement about Stella, which was written by Carl André, who had been his studio mate, for MoMA's catalog. And in there, André talks about it distancing itself from any emotion. And I came to the conclusion that that was about André. It was not about Stella. But, you know, one thing about Frank is he doesn't really interfere with what is written about him. And one of the things I would do, because I would come up with these things on my own, I'd give him the text. I say, Frank, you've got to read this and let me know if there's anything that's way off base and you don't agree with, because people are just going to assume that you told me this. Mm-hmm. And that's going to be it. That's going to be the word.
So lastly, Bonnie, I mean, it's very difficult to sum it up, but how would you assess his place in American art?
I don't think you could have American art without Stella. He really remains my touchstone. In fact, his birthday is on the 12th of May. I was hoping the Color Field book would come out by then, but I did send him the PDF a month ago. And I wrote, it's not specifically about you, but it's all about you. Because so much of my thinking about art, you know, reevaluating a lot of things that I know or I thought I knew, really comes from Frank. And there are still enough mysteries left. I will probably be working on them for the rest of my life. They are endless. Now I don't have him there to say, no, that's wrong. But actually, I've had so many wonderful moments with him. And, you know, as I said, people didn't realize how funny he was. In the retrospective that we did, there was a series in the working space all made from whiteout, liquid paper, to correct mistakes. And he made this wonderful series of works on paper. But he told the story going to the store and buying up all this whiteout. And he goes to the counter, and the cashier looks at him and said, sir, you must make a lot of mistakes. And of course, he's the first to laugh at himself on that. And I think he might have thought he had made some mistakes, but I don't think anything he ever did was a mistake.
Well, Bonnie, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you. It was a pleasure.
You can read our obituary of Frank Stella and our extensive archive of interviews with him on the website or the app. Glory of the World, Colour Field Painting, 1950s to 1983, is at the NSU Art Museum in Fort Lauderdale in the US until the 25th of August. Frank Stella, Recent Sculpture, is at Deitch Projects in New York until the 24th of May. And finally, it's time for the work of the week. Spring has at last sprung in London, so there's no more ideal subject this week than a sunlit garden. A new exhibition in the city's Garden Museum focuses on four women connected to the Bloomsbury Group and the centrality of gardens to their world. Called Gardening Bohemia, Bloomsbury Women Outdoors, and guest curated by Claudia Tobin, it features, among many paintings, photographs and other items, Vanessa Bell's View into a Garden from 1926. The picture was painted at the Charleston Farmhouse, that was a country home and refuge for Bell and other members of the Bloomsbury Group from the First World War onwards. Emma Howes, the curator of the Garden Museum, told me more. Emma, Dorothy Parker's famous saying was that the Bloomsbury Group lived in squares, painted in circles, and loved in triangles. They also spent a lot of time in the garden, according to your show. Tell us about that.
Yes, so Virginia Woolf and Vanessa Bell both had gardens quite close to each other, Charleston and Monk's House, and they both gardened and both created in their spaces. Vanessa Bell painted and worked on needlework designs and worked on designs for the Amiga workshop company, covers for her sister's books and her publishing company with her husband, Leonard Woolf. So they were very creative. Virginia Woolf, of course, was an author who wrote numerous novels and books, and she wrote quite a lot of them from the garden at Monk's House.
Now, the painting that we're going to talk about is a painting of an interior space giving onto a garden, which is rather wonderful. And of course, on the threshold, there's a vase of flowers, which look like they may have come from the garden. So there's this real sense of how the garden was part of not just their daily life, but their studio life, their art making life, right at the heart of this picture.
Yes, I mean, Vanessa Bell painted this picture. It's an interior scene, as you've said, looking from her studio into the garden. And it's a picture that's got lots set up for the sort of house setting and then the view into the garden with seats and a vase of flowers. So it gives the idea of it being a domestic space as well as her art studio, and that the garden then is part of that domestic space as well. And you mentioned the vase of flowers because the reason that Vanessa Bell and Duncan Grant moved there was that Duncan Grant was a conscientious objector. So they moved to Charleston during the war as a way to do war work to avoid conscription. And so they would grow vegetables in the garden. But as the war came to an end, flowers sort of started to take over. And this became a very important artistic inspiration for Vanessa Bell and Duncan Grant as well, in that they would both paint the garden and the flowers, but also bring flowers into the studio. And the floral motifs kind of crossed over into a lot of their work for the Amigio studios, a lot of their textile designs, embroidery designs. So the garden was very important. And also this kind of idea of inside space and outside space. And Vanessa Bell's sister, Virginia Woolf, wrote her very famous text, A Room of One's Own, where she was talking about creative spaces for women and women needing a space to be creative. And I think one of the things that we've been exploring in this exhibition is the idea that very much a room of one's own, a studio or a room to write in, is important, but also how the garden becomes a room of one's own, because lots of members of the Bloomsbury Group use the garden for creative things as artists and writers. And with Ottilie Morell, who lived at Garsington, she was a wonderful photographer. So they use them for creative things, but also as places for solace and to think. The exhibition period that we're exploring spans both of the world wars, so very turbulent times for the group as well, and very emotionally difficult times for the group as well. So how the garden becomes place for sanctuary and solitude as well.
And one feels that absolutely in this painting. It's a painting of immense calm, I think. There's obviously that wonderful exterior light and the darker interior, and Bell uses that really effectively to project an image of colour, of course, but also of a sort of tranquility.
Yes, I mean, she uses that wonderful sort of colour palette of yellows and greens, sort of quite muted and subtle tones, but there's also a lot of light and brightness there. But I think the fact that she's set the space up with chairs that are empty and looking out into the garden, you do get a sense of sadness and solitude there as well, that things aren't always quite as jovial as sometimes the Bloomsbury Group are portrayed. So I think you get this idea of the garden being somewhere that can be recuperative and emotionally restorative as well.
Yeah, and I noticed that Angelica Garnett, who is Vanessa Bell's daughter, referred to this studio where this painting was made as the citadel of the house, and that it was half studio, half sitting room. I love that, the way that art and life are mingled. It becomes an almost spiritual space as well as a working space. I really like the multiple uses that Bell was getting from this space. It was a social space, but also a solitary space and so on. It's so much at the heart of everything that happens at Charleston, right?
Yeah, and I think as an artist, Vanessa Bell was quite collaborative as well in terms of her and Duncan Grant and Roger Fry. They were all working on the Amiga workshops together, and so collaborating on a business, but also with her sister Virginia Woolf as well. She was collaborating with her, making book covers from the Hogarth Press that Virginia Woolf ran with her husband Leonard Woolf. So not only in the way that the studio is set up for domestic life and artistic life, but also the way that Charleston worked and Monk's House worked, where the sisters would travel between the two houses and the two gardens. And so I think there's sort of a collaborative nature to the whole group. And then when you widen that out to incorporate Ottilie Morel at Garsington and Vita Sackville-West at Sissinghurst, they were all writing to each other and visiting each other, and their lives intermingled. So there is a sort of collaborative nature of the group just generally.
And of course, the garden was designed by Roger Fry. As you say, in the war, it was very much a space which was providing for those that lived there. And you know, that was of course, Grant and Bell and their various visitors. But it became, as you say, much more about flowers. And it was to Fry's plan. So it was created for art as well as to be a space to be enjoyed as just a garden, right?
Yeah, I mean, Vanessa Bell's daughter, again, I think she described the garden as an artist's garden. Although Roger Fry laid it out with a format to it, very much the way it was planted, it wasn't a plantsman's garden. It wasn't a sort of very heavily designed garden. It was about the colours and forms of the plants, so very much an artist's garden.
And they would have chosen the plants themselves because they knew what would have worked best in terms of colours and forms and so on for the paintings, right?
Yeah, and I think they would visit Elphick's Nursery, which is a local nursery in Lewes, and pick plants and order plants from seed catalogues. And again, not being professional gardeners, there was probably a bit of trial and error with what would work, what would grow well, and they slowly became more knowledgeable gardeners.
I love that fact that there's a book in this painting. And even if you say it's just there, you know, she's getting, if you like, a snapshot of her studio life with a book on the chair and so on. The fact that there is a book in it, the fact that you've already referred to that extraordinary literary association with the Bloomsbury Group, is a nice detail, isn't it? There's a sort of narrative arc that emerges from that, as well as the fact that we're looking at a garden and a house.
Yes, and I mean, the vase that the flowers are in as well, I think reminds me of some of the vases that Vanessa Bell painted for the Amiga workshops. So yes, there's a lot of detail in the painting, and I think you can draw all sorts of things from it when perhaps you first look at it and you see it as quite an empty scene because there's no people in it and it shows just a corner of the garden. I think once you kind of look at it more closely, there are lots and lots of layers to the painting.
Tell us about the importance of the garden as a studio space in its own right, because is it right that as well as painting, obviously in her studio, Bell would make paintings in the garden itself, so she'd do plein air paintings outside as well?
Yeah, so definitely. I think she'd often paint the children in the garden. I think that's a kind of a subject that she returned to quite a bit, the children in the garden. And also, I think, you know, when as a mother she was carving out time to be an artist and perhaps was looking after the children, that the sort of subject of the garden became something that she could combine the two, whereas perhaps shutting herself away in the studio wasn't always an option.
Right.
So definitely she did paint the garden outside. And those pictures are perhaps a little bit different, a bit more spontaneous. They show the sort of familial aspect of life at Charleston.
But it's important, isn't it, as you emphasised earlier, to say that it was an important space for retreat for them, in the sense that you mentioned a room of one's own and that idea of what Woolf called the state of mind that's most propitious to the act of creation. And Bell seems to be really sort of emblematising that in this painting. It's a quiet space. Here she is alone, one imagines,
yep.
Even though we know so much of the sort of teeming nature of this house and garden from the photos and so on. It's important as a statement of a woman alone here making work.
Yeah, and I think obviously as well, there were very sad times at Charleston and for the family after Vanessa Bell had lost her sister, Virginia Woolf, to suicide. It's an incredibly sad time for her, and she was dealing with that grief and that loss of that very close connection. So the garden becomes an important place for her to recover and to sort of come to terms with that grief as well. So I think the garden is a space that's incredibly important to her emotionally, and living there is something that really helps her deal with that loss.
Well, Emma, thank you so much for joining us on the podcast.
You're welcome.
Gardening Bohemia, Bloomsbury Women Outdoors, is at the Garden Museum in London from the 15th of May to the 29th of September. And that's it for this episode. You can find us on X, formerly known as Twitter, at Tan Audio, and on Facebook, Instagram, and Threads. The Week in Art is produced by Julia Mihalska, Alexander Morrison, and David Clack, and David's also the editor and sound designer. Thanks also to Daniela Hathaway and to our guests, Salvi, Bonnie, and Emma. Thank you for listening. We'll see you next week. Bye for now.